Hey, Larry.
Hey, Andy.
How are you?
Fantastic.
We have springtime weather happening over here. It's been in the 70s and 80s. How about over there?
Same deal. Very, very nice spring weather. It's hitting close to 80 today.
You probably have 0% humidity.
Pretty close to it. We've been in such a prolonged period of drought that if we were to get rain, we would not know what to do with it. And I don't know if any of the few storm drains we have would actually be open and ready to receive it.
Yeah, that's not quite the case here. If you're listening to us via the website, we're delighted to have you, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or TuneIn. If you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't, just forget everything I just said. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. Even a dollar contribution would be appreciated endlessly. Oh, go ahead.
So why is it better for us? I never understand that. What makes it better?
Well, for tracking, number one, and you know, if most of our listeners come from somewhere else, it makes it. I don't want to use the term we own them, but if they come to us as the source from the beginning, that's why.
I see.
I would think.
I see. Okay, so better for us if they follow us directly.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, this first article comes from our friends down in Alabama, and I have a little sound clip for us.
I had a miscommunication, and I want to apologize to the citizens of Colbert County for that. It's going to be above and beyond what the law calls for. They're going to go out 2,000 feet. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to come behind them and do 2,500 feet.
So, is there any problem with that right off the bat? For them to go out and notify about people moving into their community more than the law requires at 2,000 feet?
Well, when you say, is there anything wrong with it, it means that question could be sharpened a little bit. Do you mean, is there anything legally wrong with it, or is there anything morally wrong with it? Which way are you coming from?
I got to think that the police could make a notification if they so choose. If it's not being required, if they just want to do that out of the goodness of their own heart. But I can see where if they're doing it by them writing their own law or going against the law that says that, then there would be problems.
Well, they have the duty to notify, I believe, within 1,500 square feet, and they're going above that. So there's no law that says you will notify up to 1,500 and stop. It says that anybody within 1,500 feet shall receive notice. So if they notify, if he says, as the Colbert County Sheriff, he says, we going to go out there and notify him I'm going to go in behind him and do 2,500. If he wants to do that, as long as he's disseminating truthful information, I think he can lawfully do that. Is it moral or right? That's another question. But it certainly would make him popular in his county. Because he's going above and beyond the call of duty. When he runs for election, he can say, by golly, I'm going to tell you this. AMO, I ain't got all the resources I'd like to have. One thing I do make a priority is I get out there and get my officers and my deputies in there to notify them when them sex offenders moving in their community, because I want y'all to be protected. That's what he would do in his campaign, and they would eat it up.
Right. But him doing that, we go back to this all the time. There's no evidence that a sex offender living in your neighborhood improves or hampers your public safety.
Doesn't have to. It makes people feel good. He's running for sheriffs or largely all elected across the country, whether it be the big Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office or Maricopa County, Arizona, or Fulton County, Georgia, or Colbert County, Alabama. They're elected. And he's going out and telling his voters what they want to hear. I'm using my resources that y'all gave me to go out there and keep you informed when there's somebody that could be a threat to y'all come moving into your community. That's what I'm going to do. And they love it.
And how many calls do you think he's gotten telling his people there that they don't want to be notified of these things?
I would be very surprised if he's gotten a single call. And if his phone started ringing off the hook saying, I want you to stop this, I can assure you that he would adjust his practices to reflect the will of the of voters of Colbert County, Alabama.
And he continues.
And we're going to give a school a list along with a picture of every sex offender in our county. And that way they'll have a way of recognizing and identifying these people.
What good is that going to do? If they're already by law banished from being in those places, why does he need to go out and further notify a school of somebody that could be in the vicinity?
Well, this would be for his argument would be that there would be lurkers who are seeking to break the law, and he's going to empower the school administration to be on the lookout, and the resource officers and the security personnel to, so that they can spot these people. Because you got to understand, from his perspective, the sex offenders are out lurking. He would never admit to you that there's no such thing, very little evidence of any stranger danger. So he wants the voters to believe that they're stranger danger because it serves his political agenda. And the voters are willing to believe it. The voters feel good about believing that there's all this danger. That's why children weigh 200 pounds today by the time they're in middle school, because children are so protected. And I think we've talked about this on one of our previous episodes about comparing the obesity rate of children today versus 30 years ago. And the overly protective parents, because they have all this fear. This sheriff is feeding that fear of all this danger that children are in, which is not existent danger.
But he would be on the front line to know exactly what these numbers are. He doesn't even have to like try and extrapolate, guess, or anything. He knows firsthand how many times people recidivate or first offenses. He knows firsthand.
But that's not relevant. If he went out there and said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to seek a cut in funding from the county commission because we've actually got too many deputies that we don't know what to do with, and we don't need to be doing some of this crazy stuff we're doing because all the stuff, danger you guys are perceiving is all in your imagination. How long do you think he would be sheriff if he ran on that platform?
But where do we have our elected officials, where do they come into the game and have some level of integrity and honesty in doing the right job, not just what gets them reelected?
I guess that's an individual choice that we have to make when we vote. If we're informed enough to know that we're being BS'd and we revolt against that by casting our ballot for someone else, that's when they'll stop doing that. When the sheriff starts getting calls, sir, you are frightening voters with misinformation, and I find that objectionable, and I will register my resentment against you in the next election if you don't cease that. He'll stop doing that at that time, but he starts getting a lot of those phone calls. But until that, he's doing what he perceives the people want.
Right, right. Well, moving on, this article comes from New York Magazine, and the title is, "What if prosecutors wanted to keep people out of prison?" And this is similar to, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, that we covered the DA out of Philadelphia, where he is like actively pursuing not sending people to prison and finding alternative ways of punishing them. And even in his campaign promises, he said that he was going to be locking up fewer people. He happens to be in an area of Mississippi that is, I think they call it the Dark Belt, I think is what they called it. That kind of isn't offensive on its own. And his predecessor, there's an example there where somebody got convicted of statutory rape of having a 19-year-old having sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend. And he got put on probation. And after that, he has a probation violation for drug use or something like that. And the former DA sentenced him to 5 years for a probation violation. And the 19-year-old goes and files a petition to get out of, or has his attorney file a petition to get him out. And the former DA just refused, wouldn't let him out. And then this guy is like, yeah, I don't see why the guy's in jail to begin with. So he gets him out, or, you know, lets the petition go through and doesn't hold it back.
Well, I don't know exactly what stretch of territory he's in, but he ran against a long-term incumbent that had held the office for a long time, and he ran on a platform promising to lock up fewer people and stop treating a drug addiction as a crime and expand rehab services, and he won.
Yeah.
So those particular voters expressed their will that they did not want to lock everybody up. But if you minimize criminality in many jurisdictions, you can't win on that platform. We'd have to take a look at the demographics of who lives there in that district and find out how he got elected. But I can assure you it's not a middle upper class white community. I can tell you that because he wouldn't have gotten elected on that platform.
Right. And that is the median income in that area is below $35,000.
Which is significantly below the national median.
Yeah, which is somewhere close to 50, if I'm not mistaken.
Something in that neighborhood.
So I just wanted to bring this up because there can be criminal justice reform, but we, as the voting population, have to decide that when somebody stands up there and says, I'm going to be the law and order president, I don't know that that's necessarily the direction that we're supposed to go.
So, well, that's what 60 plus million Americans wanted.
60, that's right.
So he said he walked across 2,000 square miles of the district, which includes his hometown of Columbus, which I've never heard of. So it's not a part of Mississippi that I spend a lot of time in. When I go through Mississippi, I'm usually driving through Highway 78 through Tupelo and down through that part of the state, and so I don't recognize where this is.
Right, and just for
our Mississippi listeners can tell us.
Certainly. And then so in one of the paragraphs says the four counties in Columbus district are part of the so-called Black Belt. Seriously? That's wow.
It has not to do with that. It says a vast stretch of originally named for dark soil that made prime cotton growing country.
Yeah.
Clearly that would be an area where there's a lot of African Americans.
Right. But Larry, can you tell me why is it that the areas with the highest poverty levels are the ones with the highest rates of incarceration?
Pretty easy on that one. There's a lot of relationship between criminality and economics. There's a direct relationship. People that lack resources engage in criminality, so the more higher the poverty rate. Now, that is not to say that I'm sitting here justifying criminality. I don't make the rules for life. I just simply observe what they are and relay them to you. Those who cannot survive any other way find a way to survive because their human instinct is to want to survive. I haven't seen that many people in my life that say, well, I just want to get out of here. It's too much trouble. I mean, it does happen. But most people look for a way to survive, and the blighted areas of our country, where economics are really tough, there's a lot higher rate of crime. If you go into our inner cities that are in decay and free fall, you'll see that there's high crime rates associated with poverty.
If we push that off to the prison model, where there are a handful of states that don't pay their inmates, do you think that there would be then a correlation between the states that don't pay and the rate of inmate aggression versus the ones that do get paid for work and a lower level of inmate aggression?
I think that would be something to be interesting to study. There may be sociologists, there may be prison reformers that have done that, but it stands to reason just intuitively, you know, that when you have people in a confined small space and tense conditions, anything that you can do to reduce stress and tension tends to promote a healthier environment for everybody, the inmates as well as the staff. So if you do the Joe Arpaio, Phoenix, Maricopa County model, where you make things as miserable as you possibly can, you tend to have a lot higher rate of violence and a lot higher settlements for negligence on behalf of the prison, the correctional facility. And conversely, if you take a place where you have a more progressive outlook on treating people. If you were to look at the Boulder, Colorado jail, which has unfortunately gotten overcrowded with the growth of Boulder, but it's still a very progressively managed facility, you have very little violence in that facility, comparatively speaking, because they do a lot more programming and they do things to ease tensions. And so it stands to reason if you have people who are not being paid anything, they're not learning the basic skills of reporting to work and receiving a payoff at the end of the week or the month, which is what's going to happen to them when they get out. You're going to want them to do that. But you're also destabilizing the environment because they don't have a means to get regularly the basic necessities of life which the prisons are not great at providing, even the basic necessities, the combs and the toothbrushes and the shavers and the deodorant and the underwear, things that we take for granted are hard to come by in prison. I haven't served any prison time, but I think that if you don't mind, you could kind of tell us how bad it is for people. What would a Georgia inmate be facing when they're totally indigent in terms of what they would have in the way of underwear, socks, shaving equipment, deodorant? What would that look like for a typical Georgia inmate?
It's meager at best, and you know they keep you down to a certain number of articles. And whenever, unless you have flat out lost something, perhaps you lost your laundry bag or whatever, you have to exchange something for something else. So you have to turn in a nasty pair of socks to get a new pair of socks. And then as far as food goes, Monday through Thursday, you get 3 meals a day. And I think it's somewhere around 1800 calories, and it's all starch. There's, you know, it's all canned vegetables, and it's the tiniest little portion. There are beans out the wazoo, and you're picking rocks out of the beans sometimes. You know, you got to be careful how you bite, because they were farmed by Georgia inmates, at least. Yeah, you laugh. Yeah. And generally, it's pretty nasty. And then,
I've eaten dry beans that have rocks. That's why I laughed. As a growing up in poverty, I'm familiar with biting into a rock.
Yeah. But then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it's only 2 meals. It's breakfast and dinner. You're stretching 15 hours between dinner at 5-ish and maybe 6 or 7 for breakfast the next day. And man, it's, you know, they're not giving you enough calories. So now how do you make it between the meals? And, you know, they're not feeding you, you know, it's not steak and lobster. Of course, and nobody's expecting that it's steak and lobster, but it's still, it's really miserable. People that have perhaps special dietary needs, they might get a pack out lunch on the weekends. It's a miserable situation. And where I would then like to go with that, though, is if people in poverty are, handouts, however you want to word that, if they are helped by the society at large to have a certain level of nutrition, aren't they then more able to make it to work?
Seems that way, Andy. The things that seem logical to us are difficult for policymakers, because you've got the public not wanting. There's a lot of people that hold legislative seats in these states that don't pay, whether it be in Mississippi or Louisiana or Arkansas, take your pick, that would like to. They know, but you've got competing interests for state tax dollars. And when you go out and try to pitch this to the masses, you just don't get a lot of public support for it. It's not something that the public, well, what the hell do you mean pay these damn scoundrels? Hell, they've already broken the law. We're punishing them. What are we going to make this, a country club next?
Right. We're paying $30,000 a year to house them. Why are we going to pay them another 20 cents an hour to do work? But in the Georgia system, they're more or less just being warehoused as it is. There's very little chance for something to keep you occupied. And otherwise, you just sit in the dorm all day waiting for inspection.
So, yeah, Georgia, unfortunately, has taken many steps backwards from decades in the past. Now, Georgia was never the beacon of all progressive models. But if you look back over the trends of Georgia Department of Corrections, at one time, it was the Georgia Department of Offender Rehabilitation. It actually had a name that they implied that was the business they were in. And they had a very progressive as far as you look at what's happened since. They had Dr. Alan Ault, which I think he's still alive. He'd be up in years, but Alan's still alive. And Alan was one who believed rehabilitation had a significant role in prisons, because we're going to be turning these people out. Almost everybody's going to get out at some point.
Yeah.
And Alan realized that if we don't make these people better, we failed, and we're going to be right back with these people dealing with them again. But it's hard to get that funding. Although if you went and talked to lawmakers, I could probably look at the Georgia General Assembly and give you a list of people that would be receptive to your arguments, but you can't get it passed because there's not enough of them because of the public backlash. Can you imagine what what is the channels two?
I don't know.
Channel two out of what they would be
WSB.
Saying WSB channel two if somebody was proposing to pay inmates up to a dollar an hour for prison labor, and we've got all of our schools that are underfunded, and we've got all these roads that are falling apart, and we've got the senior citizen centers that are decaying, and we've got all these problems, and they're talking about what a damn bunch of liberal do-good nonsense. I've ever heard anything in all my life paying these people. We're paid enough to have them locked up, and we got to be for paying them to work. That's nonsense.
The other piece of that puzzle, though, is going back to the Mississippi thing, and it just seems then that if they are somehow nutritioned, I don't know if that's a word, if they have proper nutrition to some degree and also some level of medical coverage where it's not, how am I going to get my diabetics drugs? Then it just seems that society is better off having more people productive and able to work than it does to constantly put your foot on their neck and say, hey, come up by your bootstraps.
That would seem that way to we are on the same page. I think if we do all we reasonably can, there's always more you can do if you have unlimited money, but if we do all we reasonably can to have a person who leaves prison that knows how to do a resume, who knows how to be punctual and respectful on a job, you need to for your prison employment to resemble what they will experience on the outside as best you can. Being at work on time, taking breaks on time, being efficient at your job, doing your job with being held to performance and accountability standards. We want you functioning in here as much as possible like on the outside. Managing a budget, that 20 cents to 80 cents an hour would help you to budget money, because that's what you're going to have to do on the outside if you're going to be successful. When you come out, you're going to get your $7.25 unraised minimum wage for the last 10 years as a convict reentering society, if you're lucky. And you're going to need to know how to manage that money. You're going to need to know how to do a lot of things. And prisons are the best place to prepare you for that.
Well, if you've ended up in that system, that's the only place.
But we're better off as the remaining taxpayers if you come out of that environment able to do somehow or another. The public doesn't realize that.
It seems very short-sighted.
Yeah, they'll say they'll make it if they want to make it. Really? You've been locked up for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You have absolutely nothing. And they give, I think Georgia still cuts you $25. Did you get $25 when you left?
Yeah, I got $25.
I think they used to give you a suit of clothes and $25.
They would give you a horse too.
So they didn't give you any clothes, but you didn't get your $25.
I mean, yeah, they give you the state issued clothes. They're garbage.
Yeah. And that $25 has been on the books since, I think in the 1950s or 60s.
Yeah.
And unchanged.
Certainly.
And it's kind of like the Social Security death benefit of $255.
Right.
It's been on the books since the 1930s or 40s. And it has been unchanged. So $255 in 1939 might have become a substantial way towards a funeral, but we don't change these things over time. And $25 you should probably just abolish it if that's all you're going to give a person.
Yeah. I mean, somebody's going to get out, they're going to go buy themselves a big meal at McDonald's or something like that. And that's going to wipe out half the money right there. And it just seems a horrible way to try and get someone reestablished to have a successful path. But I think the recidivism rate, at least in Georgia, is in the 60s for the general people that are released. And that has to be a contributing factor, is how the people are treated while they're in and not being prepared for when they get out.
So, well, there's the recidivism rate is high for every offense except murder and sex offenses, oddly right. enough. But the taxpayers and the public don't see the correlation. We will, if we did the ideal thing for prisoners, there would be some who would not want to play by society's rules. They're just people out there that think it's too much work to be disciplined. And they would be people out there who would not take advantage of that. And that would be fine. You would classify them in an institution where you don't emphasize programming. If the person doesn't want it and you just cannot motivate and inspire them to want to do that, then that's fine. We've got a place for you. But that doesn't mean you should give up on everybody.
Right. There's definitely a carrot and a stick program. And there is, in my experience, there is minimal carrot and minimal stick. And I have experienced being a teacher's aide, people will just say, F you, I am not learning that stuff. It is not going to help me when I get out. You're telling me that learning about just basic fractions and how to do multiplication stuff is something that you're not, that is not going to help you in working a job? I mean, if you're just going to go push a lawnmower around, then perhaps, but even still, that I it's really a struggle, and there's a broken mentality of many people that go through those doors.
So tragic.
It is. Tragic. Well, let's move on to some good news from Fort Lauderdale. This is from Florida Action Committee. Fort Lauderdale, Florida sex offender residency restrictions declared unconstitutional. And what I think is really important out of this one that I want to focus on is two brave registrants who were being kicked out of their Fort Lauderdale homes stood up and said no. And they said, hey, look, you can't do this to us because this doesn't apply to us. And, you know, I mean, they put themselves at risk for fighting back. In this case, they happen to win. So what do you think?
I think it's fantastic. The residence restriction was declared unconstitutional by a low-level judge. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, it's not an appellate decision. It's a trial court-level judge. So it remains to be seen whether or not there'll be an appeal. Generally, there is. But it's fantastic that they were able to achieve this result in a trial court. And they stood up and found the resources. I'm not exactly sure how it was funded. The case was experts. There were costly experts. Dr. Levinson and others were there, and this cost money. So I don't know if the Florida Action Committee raised the money. I haven't gotten that deep into it, but sure. It's a fantastic decision, and I hope it withstands any appeal that might come down. So
what would be the grounds? What would be the grounds for that area saying, hey, we're going to make a 1,400-foot restriction versus 1,000-foot?
What do you mean, what would be the grounds? Because that's what they wanted. They wanted to have a greater restriction than what the state law is.
Is this the I don't know what the right term is. What are the rules for a county then making a harsher restriction than a state? Aren't there states where they are banned from making something more harsh?
There are some. There are some where the challenge has been asserted that registration of sex offenders and monitoring and tracking and all that falls within the state has some control, and it's been litigated in the courts that said yes, you're preempted. But that's not universal. There's a few states where that's Pennsylvania. I can't name all the states, but there have been a few states where I think Massachusetts, where that has been ruled by the courts that you can't do anything greater than what the state does. But that opens the door for the state to toughen their laws. I mean, that doesn't mean that the state can't come in and have a 1,500 feet law. But in Florida, there's no such preemption. There in Texas, there's no such preemption. So the Texas is having a field day making competing residency restrictions to have the greatest exclusion, and the real goal is banishment. And the judge was able to see that through the help of the experts, because they excluded about 99% of the housing stock in the jurisdiction. So that required a mapping expert to demonstrate all that, to what few slivers of land were available for a person on the registry.
And does that carry any weight for a challenge in a different state or even Florida at large?
It has no precedential value. I mean, it really doesn't. You could look at the opinion and use some of this the logic. You could say that this court got it because Smith versus Doe was cited by the court in the opinion. Smith versus Doe didn't say you can register and do anything you want to sex offenders. They said, we find the Alaska scheme to be constitutional because it does not impose any disability or restraint. And so the judge says, well, conversely, looking at that, since this does impose a disability or restraint, and making a person homeless is a significant disability, and it almost resembles banishment, that based on Smith versus Doe, I can grant relief. Well, I've been saying that for a good number of years now, that you can actually use Smith versus Doe if you're creative, because you can say, they didn't say that you can do anything and everything you want to do. They said that registries can be constitutional because they don't do all this litany of things that have cropped up over the years since Smith versus Doe was decided. So I think the judge was spot on. So to that, in that regard, it could be a model for others to say, gee, maybe we do need to argue Smith versus Doe. Rather than being afraid of it, embrace it. I tell people a lot of times to embrace things that they're normally afraid of. Say that sex offender registration is a regulatory scheme. Use that to your advantage. And buy into the, if it saves one argument, say, yes, we agree. That's the reason why we should attack the First Amendment, the Second Amendment. Because if it saves one, it's worth it. You just said that, and I've just bought into your argument. You need to buy into these people's argument and use things that are counterintuitive to win. And that's what that judge did. The judge says, I'm going to rely on Smith versus Doe. Great judge.
Outstanding. I'm trying to process what you're saying. And try and come up with something crafty to say on the heels of it. But it makes a lot of, in studying how to do a debate, you have to know how the other side is going to argue against you, and perhaps then do some cool jujitsu stuff to then use their argument against them, which is what you're proposing there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want our people to quit being afraid to use arguments that you don't believe in. I don't believe that sex offender registration is civil and regulatory. I believe it's harshly punitive.
Absolutely.
But you need to say those words, because you can argue using that and saying, this is why you can't do this proposal that you're wanting to do, because it would make this very important regulatory scheme punitive, and it would make it vulnerable to a constitutional challenge. And you don't want a constitution. You don't want to lose this powerful tool that you have, do you? Because I'm going to be on your ass challenging you in a court if you do this, because you can't do it in a civil regulatory scheme. You have to be willing to admit that it's a civil regulatory scheme to make those arguments. And most people barf and regurgitate, and they can't, those words won't roll off their tongue. So they can't make a powerful argument. I can make that powerful argument all the time, and I do it. I say, absolutely, you cannot do this, because you can't do this within a regulatory scheme.
And you are working on something, and I hope I'm not letting the cat out of the bag, of trying to move the registration stuff to the DMV or the Motor Vehicles Department, because if you say it's a regulatory scheme.
I haven't gotten anything like that in under consideration as far as legislatively. But I have built the arguments for that. Since sex offender registration is a civil regulatory scheme, since you would not have that, can you think of any other civil regulatory schemes where you report to a police station?
None
are coming to mind. When you register for the draft, you don't report to the police station. When you register to vote, you don't report to a police station. So there's very few schemes I can think of where you report to a police station that's civil regulatory. So therefore, since this is a civil regulatory scheme, let's treat it like one, and let's move it away from law enforcement and move it to an agency that knows how to do civil regulatory schemes. And the first thing that comes to mind is the motor vehicle, because motor vehicles handles registrations of vehicles, boats, cars,
certainly
voters. They register all. They're set up to do registrations. So why not go, if you're going to register, and make it as benign as possible, if you're going to have a registration scheme, and do it at the motor vehicle place? There's no reason for law enforcement to be involved in a civil regulatory scheme that I can think of, unless the person violates it. That's when law enforcement, it's just like when you violate your driver's license, not having one, it's out of date. The policeman then gives you a ticket, which is a criminal citation, and may arrest you. It becomes criminal when you don't comply, but otherwise it's a civil regulatory scheme to have a driver's license.
But if you fail to register, then they act like, if your driver's license expires, they just let it go almost like a bench warrant until you are found out. You're free. In this case, the minute you fail to register, they are sending the SWAT team out for you.
Absolutely. And that's what helps you see it's not a civil regulatory scheme. But if we took law enforcement out of it, would they still send out the SWAT team?
I'm assuming that someone would get some sort of email, and the next time that person checks in, they're going to load up the paddy wagon.
Probably.
So
since it's a regulatory scheme, we shouldn't treat it nearly as seriously. It is a regulatory scheme, right, boys and girls?
Well, without a doubt. I mean, that's what everyone says. It's a regulatory thing. And right. It's in the interest of public safety.
So let's treat it the way we do any other regulatory scheme.
And not make it a continual criminal proceeding.
Well, unless the person doesn't comply. And then there would be appropriate sanctions that would be appropriate to the severity of the crime, which should be much less severe than it is across the country. I mean, it's a heinous crime in some jurisdictions. You can get, I think in Oklahoma, a minimum of 3 years if they convict you. I think Lori told me 2 to 3 years, minimum, not maximum, minimum.
Right. And I bet it's roughly a year or something like that in most places, minimum.
So
that's a significant punishment just for not showing your face and saying, hey, I'm still where I said I was.
So, well, in my state, it's a maximum of 18 months.
Not here, man. Here it's 30.
Most people get probation here on a first offense.
Here it is. First offense is a year. I think it's 5, then it's 30.
So
that's excessive. That is insanity. So anyway, all right. So tell me about your eventful week at Narsal.
Well, we had a great week. We were excited about there's a case in Arizona. Actually, it's at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but it comes from Arizona. And it's called May versus Ryan. And we're hoping to get out an announcement to the followers in the coming week. We had deadline to meet to get the brief filed, but we filed an amicus, which is a friend of the court brief in the case of May versus Ryan. And in May versus Ryan, the impossible was done by a challenger who had been convicted at trial for child molestation. And the Arizona law doesn't require there be a sexual intent for the touching on the private parts of a minor. So that would include potentially patting the butt of a baseball player for congratulatory because you touched the buttocks.
Right.
So this is a burden shifting where legislatures across the country have been too free to the defendant. And Arizona statutory scheme, the accused party can say, well, I wasn't sexually motivated, but then they have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. The burden of proof is put on them rather than the prosecutor proving that there is a sexual motivation. So we thought that issue was so important that we wanted to weigh in. So thanks to generous donations from around the country, Narsal had the money to employ an attorney to write a very, very good brief. Distinguished professor of law from Arkansas wrote brief, Professor Sullivan, and we got that brief filed in the case. The Arizona Association of the equivalent of the criminal defense attorneys, like I think they call it criminal justice advocates or whatever, the AACJ, they filed an amicus brief, and the ACLU, Johnny Come Lately, decided they would like to file one, and so they've asked for an extension of time. The deadline for filing the brief has expired, but they've got an extension. So the ACLU is going to weigh in on burden shifting. And if we can preserve that victory from the trial court finding that statutory scheme unconstitutional, if the Ninth Circuit upholds that decision, then that is a powerful statement from the Ninth Circuit that other circuits can look to say, gee, we can't tolerate this burden shifting any longer because the criminality has to be proven by the state, all the elements. We never placed the burden on the accused to prove anything. So that was an important case for Narsal. We were glad to be a part of it, and we hope that the three-judge panel agrees with the trial judge.
And the Ninth Circuit is a fairly liberal district, right?
It is. It's the West Coast. It's the largest geographic circuit in the country, the West Coast, including Arizona, California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii. And it's a very populous a circuit. And a liberal judge, Reinhardt, just died last week.
I was just about to ask you about that. I was just about to ask you.
Yeah. So it's going to get less liberal with Trump because he will not appoint anything like Reinhardt. He was appointed by President Carter, I believe.
And it's a 2-1 liberal, but now with that judge passing, it's going to be a 2-1 conservative, correct?
Well, I don't know that Reinhardt was on the panel. When you have a circuit court, they divide into 3-judge panels. So that would be a huge, the total number of judges on the court would be a couple dozen, since it's such a large circuit. So a 3-judge panel. So I don't know. I have not, the names of the judges on the panel, I don't know yet.
Okay. That's fine. Okay. Can you give us a quick rundown of what an amicus brief and also the pronunciation of this word? Cause I hear it amicus and amicus.
Either way is fine.
Okay.
So it's a friend of the court. It's a way of getting information to the court that hasn't been argued by the parties. An organization such as the ACLU or the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers are on and on. There's the National Rifle. I mean, there's on and on. People put in briefs, friend of the court. It's saying, hey, court, we've got information. We're experts. We have knowledge, and we would like to share it with you. So NARSL has a lot of knowledge in terms of how burden, particular for sexual offenses, has been shifted to the accused. So we briefed that element of the danger of burden shifting, and we cited a lot of cases. Our brief of the two that are in so far of the criminal defense attorneys at ours, we were far more comprehensive in citing case law and why this is bad. Well, you can't win on emotion alone. And so we have a very comprehensive brief that we're very proud of that was well written.
And where would people find that?
We're going to release it soon in the coming days.
So okay.
When we get the law professor to write an article about it, then we're going to link it to the brief.
And so this is going to release Monday night. I'm assuming it won't be out by the time people hear this?
I don't know if it'll be out that soon.
Okay.
I don't know if it'll be out that soon.
We'll be on the lookout for it. Maybe we'll reference it next week and give people a better way to track it down. Well, that sounds really exciting. That's cool. I had pulled up the Illinois article. Is that the opinions of the Supreme Court? Is that something you want to touch on, or are we skipping that?
Well, we can touch on it briefly. It's disappointing. That was the park restriction that applies to everybody, regardless if they're no longer required to register. And the Illinois Supreme Court overturned the appellate level court, saying that the appellate court got it wrong, that it is constitutional. The appellate court had decided that it didn't even, the law didn't even pass the most low level scrutiny, which is rational basis. And the Supreme Court said, no, you got it wrong. It certainly does pass a rational basis test. And we should do a podcast and maybe have the attorney come on, Ms. Stroll, and talk about rational basis review, because the rational basis doesn't mean rational result, and people misconstrue that. A rational basis means, was there in the lawmaker's eyes a rational basis to want to do something? Whether or not the something works is not relevant. So the fact that they want to protect people in parks, their citizens, that's a rational thing to do.
Okay.
Whether or not this actually protects anybody or not, that's not the analysis for the courts to decide. Then you get into a bunch of liberal mumbo jumbo about the courts are supposed to be super legislators and who are supposed to undo the work of the people and substitute their judgment for those that were elected. I happen to believe the court should do a little bit of that because I'm a liberal, but that's not where typically where conservatives come from. They don't want courts intervening except for in things that they disagree with, like same-sex marriage and prayer in the schools and stuff like that. Then they do want the courts to intervene. But typically they claim that they want the courts to be non-intervention, not legislate from the bench. And so these courts were acting in a very restrained conservative Supreme Court fashion. This is a very conservative, hands-off view that the legislature, they may have not gotten the best policy result, but they had the right to do it. And it's rational to want to protect the community. Whether or not it works, that's for the electors to decide whether that this is a good result. I believe that the courts have to sometimes step in and be the moral compass and advocate for the underdog who has no voice. In this case, the offenders, the convicted, have virtually no political voice, and the courts can intervene, but then you get on a slippery slope when you take that position, as where do you stop the courts from intervening? What's the proper role for the courts at that point?
Can you do me a favor and give me the opposite of what rational basis is, as far as, yeah, it makes sense that, hey, we want our people to be safe in parks. Can you give me the inverse, something that is completely ludicrous that would not pass rational basis? Take it as far out to the extreme as you like.
Well, if you were to pass something where you couldn't even state any reason for wanting the law. If you couldn't conjure up anything that sounded remotely rational,
I mean, I'm thinking of like meteors hitting the earth, and you'd be like, okay, that's not rational.
Well, meteors do hit the earth.
I understand, but okay, so that's not, they just don't do it to any frequency that it's something to worry about. So that's, I'm trying to to understand.
Well, she passed a law that said that nobody can leave their house at certain times of the day because of a meteor. But you can almost a rational basis is such a low level of scrutiny because it means that the judicial branch does not intervene in the laws you choose to impose on yourself, as long as they can articulate a rational basis for passing the law. And people want to stretch that to that the law has to be effective, that it has to be based on science. It doesn't.
Is that where the others kick in with intermediate scrutiny and strict?
Yes, that's where when you're getting into some fundamental rights, you get to higher level of scrutiny. But like I say, this would be a good podcast for Ms. Stroll to join us on. We could talk about because there is a surviving claim, the ex post facto clause, that the court's going to have to decide now, which they did not decide because they decided that it didn't pass rational basis. So therefore, they didn't need to go into the ex post facto analysis. The Florida decision, they may come back and say, well, we'll take a look at that. I don't think it's the same comparison because in the Florida, in the case we talked about earlier, 99% of the city is off limits. The park restriction puts 0.0025% of the land off limits.
Right.
So it's not the same disability or restraint. It's a very same amount of restraint or disability. So it's a different level of punishment. And I think it's going to be a lot tougher to win on the ex post facto.
Can you posit if this same thing were heard in Maryland where that disability clause is in there, do you think then that would have
it would have a different outcome possibly, okay, in Maryland, because their constitution provides a greater ex post facto. The U.S. Constitution is what most state constitutions are modeled on. They're interpreted in tandem and consistent with the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is designed to prevent punishment, and those who claim that they're conservative, they believe in the literal interpretation of what the meanings of the words would have been back in colonial times. I will positively guarantee you that the colonial founding fathers were not thinking about parks when they were thinking about punishment. When they were trying to prohibit the government from imposing punishment, they were thinking about traditional punishment. So a conservative jurist looking at this would say, well, punishment as it was understood in colonial times, not being able to go to a park does not constitute punishment. That's not Larry's position. That's how a jurist would look at this. If you jurist and said, what is punishment? What did the colonial framers mean? What did they mean by that? And they'll tell you, well, punishment was actually incarceration. Well, clearly putting a restriction they can't go to a public park is not what was colonial in colonial times understood as punishment. So therefore, it fails.
Yeah.
Now, if you take that liberal view that the Constitution evolves, that society's standards of decency evolve, and that we have to evolve with that, if you take that nonsensical Earl Warren liberal nonsense that most of our people don't believe in, then you would come up with a different result potentially, because as we've evolved, we see things differently. It's quite punitive to have excluded in your life things that you pay for. I get to pay the price for the park, but I can't use it.
Well,
I love
that. I can't remember where I saw it, but why do we have to pay for schools if we can't live near them? If we have to live out in the boonies somewhere, why are we paying for the school system?
Well, why are you paying for it? You can't participate in your kids. We could go on and on with that.
Absolutely.
So
that's of significant concern to me. Yeah, that's interesting too. It's interesting to try and see how it might come out. Obviously, we don't know how it would, but in a state with a different framework of their constitution and how that might play out. That's interesting.
They have that clause in the Maryland Constitution that it's greater than the U.S. Constitution. Any disadvantage cannot be imposed after.
Right.
So you could very make a powerful argument that this is a disadvantage, and you might win in Maryland. But in the U.S. Constitutional, it's not a violation, in my opinion, of the U.S. Constitution on this particular thing. So I think it's a weak claim, but I'm for it. I hope that she goes forward and gives it her best shot. Just be aware that it's a tough one.
That's really interesting. Before we go on, I want to thank a new patron that we got, Danielle, contributed through Patreon, and we are it was an incredibly generous donation that she gave us, a contribution. I don't really want to say donation, but a contribution. And so in a coming up episode, we're going to try and tackle the issue of mental disabilities in dealing with the registry and incarceration.
Absolutely. That's a great topic. In fact, for Danielle, we did that in a couple of conferences back in Atlanta. We had a person who has an autistic son, and we did a workshop on how difficult it is for a person to, we didn't do it, he did it, but we had a workshop given about how incredibly difficult it is for a person to navigate through the registration, through the incarceration, and then the post-incarceration registration. So we're aware of it, and it's a great topic.
And one other little administrative note before we go on too deep, before we get to this topic here. Comment came in about language on the podcast, and I am not sitting here telling any of our people to fuck off. That is not my intent. The idea behind it is to be sort of like a rallying cry. It is a motivational thing. And also a friend of mine frequently just, you know, hey, I'm tired of it. Fuck you people. So it just kind of melded into my my consciousness a little bit. And I'm using that to transfer it out to you people. And don't take offense to it. I am totally not telling you to fuck off. I'm telling those people, the ones that are trying to fight against us, telling them to fuck off.
So you had a brief fade out there, but I heard you.
Okay. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. To support Registry Matters on a monthly basis, head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at iTunes or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about us. We want to send out our big heartfelt support for those on the registry. And don't forget to say, fuck you people. You fucking matter. You make it possible. All right, so we got a comment from Jacob. And he said, I've been listening to you guys babble for about 3 months now. Everybody knows that sex offender registration is punishment, yet the two of you seem to dance around the issue. Is this just some scam to see how much money you guys can collect while pretending to be concerned about our plight? If you were serious, you people would try and end the federal registry rather than wasting so much time challenging state by state. I believe it's all about the money. First of all, Larry, how many times have I paid you for helping out with this podcast?
So far, none.
I mean, I did send you a headset.
I like that comment.
I did send you a headset. And as far as income from this podcast, there is a very low stream, and it is not about us replacing our jobs. It is perhaps about supporting the cost of it, and this is more like a hobby. But we are providing, assuming that people find it of value, we are providing a service to people too. But in the larger abstract, there are organizations such as NARSOL or Florida Action Committee or Georgia RSOL, and the list goes on, Connecticut, Tennessee, Arizona, New Mexico. Everybody has these organizations to try and build up to fight against, I guess that would be the man, right? That would be the man?
That would be the man. And I don't know of any of the organizations, even at the national level, where they're paying staffers. We just don't have that type of cash flow. We did pay the attorney for the amicus brief, but that's a necessary expense to preserve this fantastic victory. But we don't pay ourselves. This is an entire volunteer effort. The day will come where we will need to be paying staffers because organizations are really not successful. You can't have the continuity and the professional commitment that you would have with pay people that are paid, but the movement, as far as I know, no one's getting paid anywhere. I can't speak for the other two national organizations, but I can tell you that at NARSOL, no one gets paid. We incur a little bit of fundraising expenses, and we do incur a little bit of where we pay a professional fundraiser to help us, and we do incur a little bit of administrative expenses to help do our data entry and some administrative work, but there are no salaried people at NARSOL, so I don't know where he gets the idea. It's all about the money. It is about the money, but it's not on our side. It's on the other side. Right. It definitely is about the money.
Yeah, it's about prisons and keeping law enforcement employed with registration stuff. But so the other issue in here that this person has brought up is about this federal registry. Now, I mean, I just did my registration a couple months ago, and I went to my local, my county sheriff. I didn't do anything at a federal level, though.
It's very confusing, and we're probably going to run out of time before we get halfway through this topic. But there's no federal registry, and that really confuses people because they think there is, but there isn't. I've given invites for anybody to tell me when they're registering with a federal office, and no one's ever confirmed that because there's no federal registry. So we can try to tear some of the pieces back and peel back the onion and explain why they perceive that, but there's no federal registry.
So there are a handful of federal level laws like the Adam Walsh Act and the and Megan's Law that come from a federal standpoint, right?
Right, and that's what confuses people, because the feds have recognized in our system of governance in this country, we're 50 separate sovereigns, the states are, and we have that doctrine of federalism where that what's not exclusively within the purview of the federal government is for the state to decide. So the speed limits you drive on your highways, those are state rules. Your crimes, except for the federal crimes, are all punished by the states. But the federal government has the power of purse, because the federal government has more wealth than any state. The federal government rakes in more per person than any state does as far as taxation. So the federal government has long since used the power of the purse to encourage states to do things. We could go in our lifetime, we had a 55 mile an hour speed limit. That was a nationwide speed limit. It was not a federal speed limit. It was adopted by the states at the encouragement of the federal government after the oil embargo in 1973. The cars were big, large, and consumed a lot of gasoline, and those would drop mileage precipitously when it got above 55 miles an hour in terms of efficiency. So the federal government said, states, we would really like you to have a 55 mile an hour speed limit. It's in the national interest. And if you don't do that, it's you with the degradation of your federal highway assistance funds. And all the states dutifully fell in line. And for a good 10, 15 years, there was a nationwide 55 mile an hour speed limit. Then in the late 80s, as energy became more cheap and more plentiful, the states began to push back and said, particularly the western states, the Montanas, the New Mexico, the Arizona.
Where it takes you 4 hours to drive anywhere.
Yeah, they began to push back and said, that's not. And they started stubbing their nose and saying, we're gonna change our speed limit. That's an issue for state rule. Well, they do that in other things. They've done it with domestic violence. The name of it is there was something about protecting women from domestic violence. So the feds, there again, that's a state crime to do domestic violence. But the feds, in order to encourage states to have stronger domestic violence protections, they threatened federal funds. If there wasn't the enhancement of domestic violence, we could go on and on with raising the drinking age to 21. That's a state by state issue, but the federal government encouraged the states to raise the drinking age because they felt that it was safer. The national interests were better served by having a 21 drinking age. So in terms of the registry, there is no federal registry. The federal government has simply said, if you states want our dollars, we would like for you to have a registry, and we would like for you to do certain things within the registry requirements. But there's no federal registry. But that gets very confusing to people, because they hear about the Adam Walsh Act. They don't hear about the other things that were passed, like the Real ID Act.
Right.
A few people have heard about the Real ID Act, but all these things that they're going through with Real ID, the states issue identification. There's no federal, there's no national ID card except for possibly a passport you could consider some sort, but there's no federal ID office you can run down to get an ID. You go down to your state office, but the federal government has said, there again, using the powers that they have, which are enormous in the case of ID, because they say, we will not let you in federal establishments, federal bases, federal buildings, or we won't let you board commercial aircraft, because under the Bush administration, which is the pro-business administration, they federalized the aviation security and they took it out of private hands. And that sounds like something a bunch of damn liberal do-gooders would do. But they took aviation security away from the private sector and put it in federal hands. So now the feds determine who gets on the airplane. So they used the power of the control to force the states to enhance their IDs and make them much more secure and do things that are very difficult for a lot of people to comply with. So that's the correlation. But there's no federal registry. The states have been encouraged to build registration models, and states have built them, and many states have exceeded their federal requirements, but that's their choice. And they have the right to do that.
Can you go over any of, so certain states have 2,000 or 2,500 foot restrictions and other states have none. So is that not even in the statute anywhere that they have to comply with some sort of residency restriction?
There's not even an encouragement from the feds to have residency restrictions. That is nowhere in any federal legislation. It wasn't in Megan's Law. It's not in the Adam Walsh Act. It's one of those things where I get phone calls at National saying, well, I hate the Adam Walsh Act. I said, why? I hate these damn residency restrictions. I said, well, you're hating the wrong thing. You need to be hating your lawmakers in your state capital. That's not in the Adam Walsh Act.
Where do you think they get this this misinformation?
Well, we on the advocate side are a little bit responsible for it, because when the Adam Walsh Act passed, most states did have to toughen their requirements. Very few states were already totally substantially compliant, so there were missing ingredients of the Adam Walsh Act. So the fact that they had to, it may have been that they were registering enough offenses and they were registering the people for a long enough period of time to meet the federal requirements, but they might have had too long a period of time. They might have had 10 days or 14 days to initially register, where the federal standards were 3 days. So they started hearing that these laws were changing because of federal requirements. So they associate any change that came down the pike to be instigated by the federal law, which is not true. But I think it's a complicated issue where people don't understand what's necessitating the change. A lot of changes are being driven by victims. The victims, let me pick on victims a little bit. A lot of the stuff is being driven by the victims. The victims have figured out that it's a lot easier to lobby Congress. A sustainable annual budget, which NARSL is barely sustainable with our limited, but like the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the national organizations that fight for victims, they have for like the Adam Walsh Act, that was by John Walsh, who had resources. He had been doing the TV show for decades,
right?
But before he passed the Walsh Act, he had a following. They figured out that it's easier to lobby in one location and use the power of the federal Congress to inspire states to do something than it is to go lobby in 50 capitals, although they still lobby in 50 capitals. But if you can mandate something at the federal level that the states are going to probably comply with, that saves you from having as much effort. It reduces the workload at the state level. So when you pass the Adam Walsh Act, which John put a lot of effort into passing that for his son, the states are out there, and they're being told that if you don't comply, you're going to lose funds. And then the public hears, well, if we don't do this, we're going to lose funds. And nobody wants to lose those federal funds, although they hate the federal government, which is always that just blows my mind they'll bend over backwards to get the money from the entity that they hate so much. But that's another program.
Well, that's what was happening with the same-sex marriage stuff. They were going state to state to state, and it was in the dozen, in the above 12 or something like that, when they finally, when it became a Supreme Court challenge, and that's when they ruled, and that made it a 50 state thing.
Yes.
So, well, then to support this guy's comment about it, can't we challenge something at the Supreme Court level to do that, or legislate Congress to do something along those lines to help us?
We could do both. Getting a case to the Supreme Court.
Packingham.
We did that with Packingham.
Yeah,
of
course.
Media ban. That case made its way to the Supreme Court. Getting a case to the Supreme Court, though, won't end registration. It might end registration at the level that the Supreme Court finds that you finally, like in this Doe versus Snyder in Michigan case, where they finally ramped up so much that the Sixth Circuit said you can't go any further. The Sixth Circuit didn't say you can't register people.
Right.
they said, we looked at this registration scheme and you went too far here. So say a case of egregious registration makes it to the Supreme Court, and say these nine justices, that even though we've got a tilt toward the conservative side, say one or two of the conservatives join the liberals, and it comes down that they find that registration scheme is unconstitutional. Nothing stops that state or all the other states from going back and saying, well, the Supreme Court is really concerned about X, Y, and Z. We need to take that out of our registration requirements. And then you're back to a brand new challenge.
Right. And then, so then they've just reduced the bar, reduced the threshold to which you could actually perform a challenge. Maybe I should say raise the bar, making it further out of reach to hit something against them. If they reduce the burden, it's harder to challenge it, is what I guess the way I'm wording that.
Yeah, suppose they were defined that the frequency of reporting is too much like probation, thus it resembles punishment. Thus, right. you can't have people report in every 90 days. Well, what would stop them from doing like New York does, where they have to come in every 3 years?
Right, right.
What would stop them from doing that?
Or making it like, I think you said Vermont, where it's just like a mail-in card or something like that?
Mail-in a form. Yeah, what would stop them from doing that?
Right. That would make it a much more palatable situation for those of us on it to deal with it.
It would. Or your other part of your question was, legislatively, if the Adam Walsh Act were to be repealed at the federal level, since we have no federal registry, it would repeal absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
It would just repeal the encouragement to the states that they have registries that meet these rigid standards.
But the public is very popular with the public. So even still, they would be like, well, I need my state registration thing. I need to go to my website and find out who's living next door.
Right. That's where I'm headed. Well, that doesn't mean that any state would magically repeal their registry, because that state is a sitting duck for an influx of people. I mean, if a state raises their hand and says, well, I'm going first, I'm going to repeal my registry. I have to believe, I mean, I can't say for sure, but I have to believe that people would start moving to that state. If registration is as bad as what we hear it is, and I believe it is as bad as what we hear it is, why would you stay in Florida when you could move to Oregon when they abolish their registry? You would have to be totally insane to stay in Florida, where right. you have to live under a bridge, when you could go to Oregon where you could get a job. So of course people would move to Oregon. So that makes it very difficult for a state to take the lead and say, I'm going to. So you'd have to, in the repeal, you'd have to get language in the repeal that would encourage the states to registration requirements, because we've learned you'd have to be crafty enough that you would word the legislation that the states are encouraged to undo what we were wrong at the federal level. We encouraged you to make these beasts. Now we see we're wrong. You'd have to encourage the states and give them some kind of incentive to pull back. Otherwise, nothing would change. The day that Trump signed the repeal, which would never happen, but the day that Trump signed the repeal, all 50 registers would be operating exactly like they are today. The only difference would be that if you totally abolished the Adam Walsh Act and you abolished the Marshall's the Fugitive Apprehension Task Force component, the people that exempt themselves from registration by not following the requirements when they move from state to state, they would no longer be federal marshals pursuing them. That would be the only difference. You would have fewer people being tracked, because the state that they left from has no interest in tracking them. They're happy that they're gone.
Right. Is this related to the 10th Amendment of states, their sovereign entities?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
The states, we have 50 separate nations within the United States.
Right.
And people find that very confusing. We've got a listener or a member up in Minnesota, and he comes unglued about that all the time. He says, well, isn't this one nation? Yes, it is the United States, but it's a united federation of 50 states.
And that's why there are 50 constitutions.
50 constitutions, 50 legislatures.
And that's why is the whole thing of the Commerce Clause in the Constitution, because 250 years ago, it was kind of difficult to move commerce across state lines.
It was.
And now it's now it's nothing to get in your car and drive 2 hours and you're in, if you're in the Northeast, you've crossed three or four states in 2 hours.
So, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, no doubt. So, but what would be the case for there to be federal laws initiated to make to go against sexual offenses? I mean, and I say that if you do some sort of sex trafficking across state lines, same as if you move drugs across state lines, now you've entered into federal jurisdiction.
There are federal sexual offenses that are prosecuted federally. Traveling to meet a minor,
right,
is one. Taking a minor across the state lines for sexual purposes. Transmitting obscene images of underage, which for federal purposes is defined as anyone under 18. All those trigger a federal jurisdiction. Crimes on the reservation Indian land,
right,
prosecuted in the federal. So there are sex crimes that are federally prosecuted, but even those people register with a state registry. There's no federal registry.
Okay, that was my next question. So you commit some sort of child porn thing on the internet, you're going to register in your state?
Pursuant to the state law.
You're just going to register with your local jurisdiction, county sheriff, Pennsylvania, it's the state police barracks, whatever. You're just going to register with the normal state entity where you're residing.
Correct.
Okay.
And in compliance with the state law. And that confuses people. So they look at the Adam Walsh Act, for example, and they see that under the federal standards that child porn is a tier one offense, which is 15 years, and then 5 years can be reduced for no criminal conviction, no felony conviction within the 10 years. So they see themselves as a 10-year offender, but they look at the registration requirements in the jurisdiction they're living in, and it's lifetime, for example, whether they be in Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, New Mexico. They see that, and they say, well, how the hell can they do this to me? The federal law says this is a 10-year offense. Well, no, you're confused. The federal law says that we would like you to have a tier level no less than this tier for this offense. Go above that. So since Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, New Mexico, and all those states went longer, they met the minimum standards of federal law. And since there's no federal registry, you're going to register consistent with the term that's required by that state registration scheme. So I get calls about that quite frequently, that well, my crime, according to the federal standards, is a here too, but yet they say I'm lifetime. I said, well, but there's no federal registry. And those are just guidelines, suggested minimums. You can go above those. And states that have implemented the Adam Walsh Act, most all of them have gone above what they needed to do. And that's what confuses people, because they put a lot of people at lifetime that don't need to be. That lifetime designation is really a very much more narrow group of offenders than what many states have, like even Pennsylvania. They put a lot of people in lifetime in tier three in Pennsylvania, didn't need to be to even meet the federal standards. Same thing in Maryland.
Why does it take so long to get a case up to the Supreme Court?
Well, because the Supreme Court is not a court of original subject matter jurisdiction, except in very narrow circumstances, like in disputes between the states. But in the Supreme Court, cases have to work their way up to the Supreme Court, because there's only 9 justices and they can only hear so many cases. They're only in session so many days a year. So you can't just go file something in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to agree that it wants to hear it. And there has to be an exhaustion of all the opportunities to resolve at a lower level before you can get to the Supreme Court. And then you have to petition the Supreme Court with what's called a petition for certiorari. And the Supreme Court decides if it wants to hear your case. So like this Florida case, for example, on the ex post facto challenge at the county court level, that would have to be appealed through the appellate level courts in Florida, which there's usually one level of appeals courts, and then the state Supreme Court. And then if they were to exhaust and not get the outcome that they wanted, which they're happy with the outcome they got, but say the state were to appeal and lose at all levels, the state could file a petition for cert with the U.S. Supreme Court. So it takes years for those cases to get to the Supreme Court, just to exhaust at the lower levels and get to the Supreme Court, because it's not a court of original subject matter jurisdiction. That's why.
Just to cover something that is of interest lately, would the Supreme Court hear a case about the president as an original matter?
No, not necessarily. You're probably talking about Bush versus Gore.
No, I'm actually talking about the Monica Lewinsky stuff and Paula Jones thing from Clinton stuff. They determined that he could sit as a sitting president. He could stand trial.
Who's they determined that?
The Supreme Court.
And what was the case?
It was since he had committed his offense outside of the office that he was subject to be a defendant in a court setting.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
So I'm assuming that would be original action.
No, I don't think it was original action. I think that case worked its way up to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
So
interesting.
But yeah, there are very limited number of things that can go directly to the Supreme Court. There are things, but it's a very, very narrow things where the Supreme Court Chief Justice presides over the impeachment trial by the Constitution.
Right.
But there's a whole lot of things that you have to work your way to the Supreme Court, and people don't understand that. They ask, why don't you just file it at the damn Supreme Court, and get it over with?
Well, sure. I mean, if it's violating the Constitution, why wouldn't you just go do it?
Because we can't. That's the reason.
So the reason probation and parole mess with you is because they can, and they are going to do it until they stop. And the reason why we don't just bring a challenge to the Supreme Court is because we can't.
We have to develop the case below. And what unfortunately happens below too often is that the cases that are not properly developed.
Yeah.
Like this case in Florida was properly developed with experts. It was done, as far as I can see, quite well. But too often, a person will file a challenge to registration as a part of a criminal case, which doesn't really lend itself to development of a civil court a case record, where you take testimony and do the things that you do in a civil setting. So most of these things need to go through a declaratory judgment action rather than someone saying, but they go tell their public defender, I want you to file something. And the public defender files something to placate the client. And the case goes up. I was an expert witness in a case where we were doing it through the public defender because we wanted to challenge an ex post facto, make an ex post facto challenge against the enhanced registration requirements. And we had no funding, we had no experts, and we got our ass kicked because we were trying to do it in a criminal case. But unfortunately, people do things the best way they can. A lot of people file pro se stuff. The Tenth Circuit case of the ID out of Oklahoma. That was a shabbily done case because a prisoner was doing it pro se, and he was determined that he was going to appeal. So we got an amicus brief filed in that, but it was not persuasive. Unfortunately, we lost on that one.
Got it. Did we miss anything?
So we always miss stuff, Andy.
Did we miss anything in the immediate that we can't circle back and fix later?
I would like to come back to this federal registry and stuff on a regular basis because we have new listeners coming in, and this is one of those things where it's confusing enough that we can encourage people to ask specific questions mm-hmm. and try to help them understand because it is complicated. All this stuff is complicated.
Well, you're not a podcast listener. There's a podcast I started listening to about programming, and I went through, they've been doing their show for two-ish or so years. I went back through and started collecting all of the old episodes, and I just go work my way through the back catalog. It's one of the beauties of podcasting is that you can, hey, go back and listen to episode one where we talk about what the registry is. It's one of the benefits of it where it would be hard to go back and listen to a Rush show from 6 months ago. Our shows are, you can listen to the entire back catalog, subscribe with your podcast feed thing and start at episode one.
Is there an easy way to index what we've talked about so they can know how to find particular things that I'm not a podcast person either. I just got roped into this, but is there a way?
You make it sound like I'm torturing you. Come on, man.
Is there a way for a listener to figure out what we've talked about previously?
Well, the episodes are titled and I try to come up with something that's sort of clever so that the search engines like it. I'm not just saying like, you know, last time we had the quote from the person talking about representation, there go the people, I must follow them. But then I put the show notes in there. So if you're looking for kind of a subject, you should be able to kind of search and find what you're looking for.
Well, that's good to know because I'd like to use this as a resource when people call,
yes,
contact NARSL. I'd like to be able to say that, well, actually, we've covered that.
Yep.
Go look at Registry Matters. We've done shows on that. We've gone into detail on that, and then that saves me from having to have a one-on-one conversation.
Yep.
The beauty of modern technology, we're talking to hundreds rather than one.
Yep. And then it's archived, and you know, maybe we have to change something because the rules change along the way, or the regulations change along the way. But yeah, certainly these, we could go back and we can circle back. We can answer questions. You know, if someone says, hey, I listened to episode 5 and you talked about this, we can cover that again if you need to. And, you know, as a point where our most listened to episode has to do with about compelled speech at the moment. And I have a feeling that we could dig into that one and get more expert opinion on how that all works out.
So, well, our packet loss has been all over the board tonight. So
it has been.
We've come across, hopefully we've been consistent.
It's been there. You've come through. You've broken up a couple times at off to go clean up, but otherwise you've been basically there. But yeah, you're struggling again tonight. Hey, so I was just thinking about this while we were talking, though, is that part of the money could be something to help provide Larry with some better internet. Because you've got some shitty internet, man. You've got bad packets.
Well, we're in a state that has, I guess, technological challenges here. And even in an urban area, we're apparently having a problem. But even out in the rural areas, but I understand, I can't quote the terminology, but we're behind the times here.
It's really bizarre considering where we are at this stage of the game. Considering where I am as far as, you know, being in the back-ass country here. Anyway, Larry, I always, always, always appreciate it. Enjoy the time with you.
Thank you, Andy.
Have a good night. Bye.
Good night.